Welcome to the Herbs with Rosalie podcast, a show exploring how herbs heal as medicine, as food, and through nature connection. I'm your host, Rosalie de la Forêt. I'm an herbalist teacher and the best-selling author of the books Alchemy of Herbs and Wild Remedies. I created this podcast to share trusted herbal wisdom so that you can get the best results when relying on herbs for your health. I love offering up practical knowledge to help you dive deeper into the world of medicinal plants and seasonal living. My goal is that you'll walk away from each episode feeling inspired to start working with herbs in your everyday life. Each episode of the podcast is available on my Herbs with Rosalie YouTube channel, as well as your favorite podcast app. Transcripts and recipes for each episode can be found at herbswithrosaliepodcast.com. To get the latest news as well as fun bonuses, be sure to sign up for my weekly herbal newsletter. Okay, grab your cup of tea. Let's dive in. Well, I chatted with Liz a few days ago, and I'm now sitting down to record this introduction. And in the days since, I keep thinking of her and her absolute delight in the beautiful, small, everyday things. She reminds me a little of a fairy, you know, with her sparkly smile and her deep-rooted love of the green world. And I also just keep thinking of her ponderings about how much joy plants can bring us and how, for some of us, it's unimaginable to think of life without them. This episode doesn't contain lots of medicinal facts. It's so much bigger than that. Instead, I invite you to soak up Liz's infectious joy and bring it into your everyday life. For those of you who don't already know her, Liz Knight is a teacher and author from the borders of England and Wales. As a child, she loved gardening and cooking. Later, when she bought a secondhand wildflower ID book complete with handwritten notes courtesy from its previous owner about how to eat the plants, her life was sent on a different, more delicious path. In 2021, after 10 years of teaching foraging and running an acclaimed wild food business, her first book about edible wild plants, Forage, was published to global acclaim, selling out in weeks. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, Buds and Blossoms. Welcome to the podcast, Liz.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be here with you.
Oh, likewise. And I love in your bio your origin story of how you got turned onto plants, one of your stories, and how it came from the secondhand book that somebody had written in. That is just so wonderful. Yeah. And what a beautiful story, because that person writing in the margins had no idea they were going to transform your life with this.
Do you know what? Yeah, I was trying to find the book actually this afternoon, and I have a companion copy that this isn't the one that was written in, but it's the same Collins guidebooks. Yeah, and it was years and years ago, and I must have got it from a secondhand shop, and it had written in alongside the plants, just like how people would use stuff. So things like, you know, could have had things like uses for tinder, but then it was stuff like you can use this in a salad, or you can use the roots as a vegetable. And that person has no idea that kind of their writing literally was the thing that made me start foraging and start wondering about plants, because they were all plants which weren't particularly at the time. It wasn't really, I mean, obviously there were people who have foraged forever, but we were in that kind of lull of time, especially in the UK, where wild food was seen as being a little bit what we call knit your own wellies, you know, a little bit really far alternative. And so no one kind of in the mainstream was doing it. So it was my way in was this book that, you know, someone, whoever they are, I'm really grateful to them, wrote in the sides, you know, kind of had really kickstarted my journey on foraging. But yeah, it's very precious. It's obviously not so precious that I haven't just gone and lost it, though. My kids have their notes in it.
I just love that story so much. It makes me want to like go buy a whole bunch of books and write in the margins and drop them off at used bookstores, yeah. You know?
I think we should, though. I think we should write. I have a real thing for old books and my granny's cookbooks and just old books. I love old cookbooks which say things like, take a chicken, put it in a warm oven.
In one of the books I've got, there's a description on how to tell how hot your oven is, because in all the old cookbooks say things like just put something in a warm oven or a cold oven or a hot oven, and there's no temperature gauges with it. But what people used to do, and we still, because all our ovens are different, is you put a piece of paper into the oven And how long it takes it to go brown determines how hot your oven is, and whether it's a warm oven or a cold oven, you use that piece of paper. And I just love that, you know, it takes, food and cooking should be really easy, and it should be really simple. And I think all of those old cookbooks that like were written in the, you know, right up until the 70s and 80s, I suppose, were so much simpler, you know, and you had to rely on, I suppose, your produce being good, and also your kind of learned skills. You knew how to make a gravy, you knew how to do this, because people just sort of grew up around watching people do stuff. And that's kind of why, how I approach food, I suppose, and foraging and plants, I suppose, is that I kind of want them to be really accessible for people. And like that person, like the person who wrote in this, not this book, the equivalent of this book, made for me by just writing, make that into a salad, have that in, you know, cook that as a root, that kind of thing. You know, it's making things easy for people to get, because it is the easiest thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we should be doing.
Well, that is just kind of this like perfect segue into your newest book coming out this spring, Buds and Blossoms. So I've gotten to see a preview copy. It's absolutely stunning. It's so beautiful. So just visually, it has a sense of just like, wow. I mean, it really is wow.
I've got a copy here. So I show it. Yes.
Wonderful. Yeah. And it's so incredible. But one thing that really jumped out beyond the aesthetics, which is so incredible, is that I love your approach and that your recipes are totally stunning. And they're really original things I haven't seen before, incorporating these buds and flowers into meals from sweet to savory. But I love the simplicity. Like I looked at every recipe thinking like I could make this. And I am not
Good.
Somebody,
I'm so
kind
glad.
Of famous for making recipes, but I'm actually not somebody who loves to spend hours of like complicated things in the kitchen.
Me
I don't
neither.
Like it when it's like a fail. I don't like kitchen fails, you know, like, oh, I just put all this time and effort into this thing and it's just like not good. Everything is so simple. The ingredients are simple. How you put it together is so simple. So yeah, just super approachable. And I saw that in the book immediately and thought, this is really
cool. I'm so glad. I write for, I suppose, for people like us. You know, I'm not good at following really complicated recipes. And also I'm really conscious that people don't have vast amounts. People spend a lot of money on cookbooks, you know, and it's an investment. And I'm really, really conscious that, you know, it's a chunk of your wage gone on buying that. And actually, you know, that if you then can't use it, if these things can look beautiful and be really chefy and actually be impossible to do and not in real life. Whereas actually these plants that we've got are so delicious, and you're not going to go eating, you know, cherry blossom every day of the year, for example. It's an ephemeral thing that you can just have a, you might even just cook one or two meals with that plant, but that connection you get needs to be something that's joyful rather than like really stressful in the kitchen saying, oh, I haven't got all of these things. And also recipes are like the recipe books that I love, the old ones, they really should be spring points. So I kind of try to write in a way that it's through the book, lots of references to like, you could do this, you could turn your magnolias into fritters with chocolate, you know, but I haven't got the recipe in there for it because you've got to go away and do that work, because actually that's where the confidence in you to becoming, you know, we should be developing our own kind of recipes of our own families and our own areas and stuff. And so yeah, I hope it inspires people to cook, and I hope they cook and enjoy the recipes, but also I hope that people kind of go off and do their own version and don't worry about the fact that you might not have rice wine vinegar. You can swap it. You can, you know, doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
Nothing is. And that's what makes life good.
Yeah. Well, I am excited to talk more about your cookbooks, plural, that you have coming out. But before we dive into those, just to go back to your story again, like, so you got this, you know, you read in the margins of the book what you could do with plants. It got you interested. And then what? Tell me what happened.
I don't quite know. I mean, I've always just loved plants and things, the world. It's not just plants. I've always felt really, really lucky that I never lost the sense of wonder about the world and how amazing it is and how beautiful things are. and I'm really contented in a very small space. So I haven't been abroad for so many years. You know, I can pretend that it's purely for ecological reasons. To be honest, you know, my young family, too many kids and too many dogs to be able to go abroad. But I don't feel a sense of loss that I haven't had a chance to travel, because actually I'm really walking down my lane and seeing a view and seeing a cloud form a shadow on a tree. That to me is like going to Taj Mahal. You know, I can't genuinely get the same experience, or looking at a flower, or smelling, there's a line of poplar trees near where I live, and it's got, there's pineapple weed next to it. Oh my goodness, that smell is like the most beautiful thing in the world, you know. And so I'm quite content with the magic of small things, being able to look up and see them. Okay, it's not a small thing, but you know that the wonder of it all. And for plants and food really is part of that, you know, and part of that beauty. And then the fact that they heal, and the fact that they can feed you, so they're not only beautiful. So I used to love gardening, and then suddenly discovering you can eat these things, and you can eat the things that make you feel so happy. So that I was already getting a thrill out of them from when I was a child. I used to lie, you know, in, I was very conscious of just being amazed by it all and feeling so lucky. You know, I'd lie in long grass and we're just, you know, at a pre-teen, and I can remember feeling incredibly lucky just to be on, you know, having the warm sun on your face and that kind of thing, and seeing insects and how amazing it was to be alive. That's what it is. And it just, I think plants just connect you to that kind of, we are part of this wonderful world. We're not separate to it, and we've all become so very dislocated from it, haven't we, that we've forgotten that we are part of nature, and that we are just very transient, and we're inconsequential in the grand scheme of it, which makes life even more amazing, really.
Well, I really resonate with that, Liz. So I do travel extensively abroad. I'm called back to Europe a lot and to Mexico. And it's strange, in the past couple of years, when I leave home, I miss it so intensely, because like I'm about to go actually in a month. I'm going to spend a month in Europe, and I'm going to miss so much here. I'm going to miss my plants here. Like, as you said, it's so ephemeral, and things, you know, like I'm going to miss out on things that just like, it feels huge to me. So it's interesting. Like I have family in both places, and so I'm going for family, and I love traveling so much when I was younger, but now it's kind of like, oh, I just really feel like the heartache of missing my plants at home. 'Cause those are what I have a real connection with. And then of course you see plants when you travel, but to me, it's just not quite the same as the plants that, like, you know, the plants that I know and love here, like actually individual plants even, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I resonate with that a lot, and how, when you're that connected, and how, you know, especially when it's this like, you know, interdependence and interconnectedness of eating those foods, tending the plants. Yeah. There's just this back and forth that it's just really, So I love that, the beauty in small things, that connectedness that we feel. To me, that's just so more, you know, increasingly important.
Oh, it's so important. It really is, you know, and I think it's so easy. I live just in the beginning of the Brecon Beacon, so very ancient kind of landscape. And it's really easy to not even be aware, because you do your daily grind and you can drive past and you don't notice things. And every morning I have to drive my kids downhill, down sort of 5 miles to the bus to school. And you drive, and there's a really lovely old mountain called the Skirrid, which was the devil's footprint kind of cut out, apparently part of the Skirrid. So it's a very famous mountain in the UK. And you drive towards it, you see it. And opposite where we live is a little hill called the Dawn of Day. And it's only, and the sun rises behind it, but it only rises where we live, because obviously, you know, no one else can see that. So it must have been named by someone at some point, it's Dawn of Day. And it's magical, and it'll be so easy. It's so easy to, you know, be trying to get to what you've got to do really quickly, that actually you miss the process, don't you? And the process is the thing. You know, wherever you are. And I know I'm speaking to a point of privilege, because I live in a beautiful place. I grew up not far from London in a, you know, normal town, still saw the beauty, and there's beauty everywhere, isn't there? There's beauty in a little side street or a park, or, you know, a bird coming and singing, you know, on a street lamp. There's, you know, And I think that it's something that we particularly need now, don't we, more than anything,
Yeah,
is to
so
see that
true.
wherever
And what
you
a
are in the
gift.
world.
Absolutely. And what a gift that the plants are there to remind us.
Huge gift. I mean, it's huge. And I don't know, I feel so incredibly lucky, that I don't know what it's like to be scared of running out of food. And I don't know whether you find that, I don't know what it's like to not feel, I know I have to, my kids were at the doctor's today, they're ill. And so we still use the kind of conventional medical system, but I know I can spray a bit of honeysuckle onto their throat to help relieve, and I know that I can provide, and I know that I can do those things. And I wonder how much that affects. I wonder what person I'd be if I didn't know those things, that freedom, and to know that that there's, I don't know it all, I know hardly anything. In reality, you're always learning, aren't you, and discovering new things and discovering all the stuff, which again is amazing. But I wonder how different my life would be if I had lots of money, but no kind of liberation and knowledge that I can do things to help myself.
Yeah. That I feel you on that one, because that really is like true richness, is that connection, and
It is.
yeah, and seeing our
It
place within it all.
is. I was going to say, when I was in my early 20s, I was in a job which paid far too much money, and that was the kind of job where you'd be the last in the office, you got promoted, that kind of thing. I used to wear this kind of stripy shoulder padded suit, and I never fitted it. I was always a bit kind of like spunky, and I used to walk through a big park to get to work, and I didn't know what I used to do. I used to be an account manager and would have kind of meetings with quite senior people within the local government, and I'd pull out my files, because obviously it was before the internet, you'd have like your files, and all my files would be like squished hawthorn berries or kind of rotting elderberries, because I'd just be picking from, I had no idea why I was doing that, and I wasn't foraging at the time. I was just like, well, that's interesting, I'll put this. And in my bag would be all this kind of like rotting squished stuff that I didn't last very long in that world. But I got made redundant after the year 2000, when there was the big crash, and everything, because I was working in IT, and we all thought the world was going to end because of the millennium bug. When I got made redundant, we just moved into a little flat in the middle of the countryside, so we've moved out to the city, into the country, and I was given this tiny bit of a weedy kind of bit of ground to garden. And I can remember being in this garden. So we had no money. My husband had just trained as a teacher, so he was on a student teacher salary. So we were really gone from having too much money but lots of stress to having nothing and free time to garden. And I was pulling up stuff thinking, that smells like onion. What a lovely shame I can't eat it. That smells like garlic. What a shame I got, not realizing it was all pulling out the Japanese knotweed. Not really, so I should be going and cooking it. But I can remember one moment, literally having this moment where I could feel my heart beating slowly, and I could put my hand on, and I was thinking, that's really strange. And it was going slower and calm, and my breathing was slow and calm, and I suddenly felt, like you said, rich. I suddenly felt like the richest person in the world. So I was like, I've got it, that's it, just enough. I had just enough, but I had time to be able to appreciate that stuff. And I think that, that's where our poverty is, hugely in lack of time now to be able to do those things.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story, Liz.
Oh.
You're a wonderful storyteller with these like kind of poignant stories. And when Buds and Blossoms, your new cookbook, you begin speaking about Rose and talking about when you were a child and like falling in love with Rose and the smell, and then how you instinctively wanted to like make potions with it. And that's something that I have heard on the podcast a lot of plant people, that they like some of their first memories are making like mud pies with plants, or just, making perfumes or potions or whatever. And when I read that story in your book, it just made me think of like, oh, I think, what's happening is like this is our ancestral DNA just coming out in us, that this is like what we
It is.
should be doing, even though it hasn't been
Yes.
taught to us. And
No.
here in my cases, some people are taught this, but I was not. Yeah. So I just kind of feel that it's like just like this bubbling up of like, yeah, this is what we should be
But
doing.
why do we want, and why do we want to do it? And I would have pounded and smell it. And at the same, one of the things I wrote about in the book was that at in two regions of the world, the oldest civilizations, so the Indus Valley and the Mesopotamia, at exactly the same time, that thing that I was doing with making potions and stuff, those civilizations were distilling rose water. You know, thousands of miles away, they wouldn't have ever known each other, they never met, they wouldn't have known the technologies, and they had the same technologies because they were wanting to do the same thing with roses. And I just think that that's just amazing. That, you know, all over, and that doesn't just happen with rose, does it? It happens with other plants as well. You know, how, you know, kind of calendula and tagetes being used on different continents for the same thing, for worship and for this, you know, for kind of embalming the dead and all these different things that, you know, we've evolved alongside. They're so in our DNA, aren't they? They're so, we walk in their footsteps. They've been there before us.
And so you've chosen rose to be your plant for the show, and
I have.
It seemed very fitting when I read that that was like the book, you know, where you started in your book, and obviously you have a lot of love for rose. So yeah, I'm excited to hear what you have to share.
Well, I do have so much love for rose that when I was 4 years old, we went as a family on holiday, and we were at a beach, a really, really crowded beach, and I clearly don't have any memory of this, but I don't have a middle name, but I'd always wanted my middle name to be Rose. So obviously my love of Rose had gone back a long time. And my parents were absolutely petrified because I'd gone missing. And so they were just really, it was in Cornwall, this really crowded beach in Cornwall, and they were all searching for me. And then there was a loud hailer, and over the loud hailer came Will Elizabeth Rose's parents, five-year-old, I wasn't five, I was four, I kind of made that up as well. Will five-year-old Elizabeth Rose's parents come and collect her from this place, she's been found. And then, so they didn't give my surname or the right age, but they immediately knew that it was me that I had been.
I love that.
So yeah, I think I've always loved, well, saying that, I've always loved Rose, but I kind of go through periods where I'm like, I didn't particularly like, they, you know, the kind of, I suppose, where I grew up, there were lots of those very blousy kind of, like the rose in my mum and dad's garden, quite gaudy coloured roses, and they smelt amazing, but they weren't like kind of, you know, poetically beautiful roses. They were like the big kind of like, roses. There was a big rose grower near where I lived, and everyone had them in their gardens. So it wasn't like, it was actually, it became a plant, but I was like, oh, this is really kind of 1970s, you know, petunias and roses. And so actually I kind of re-fell in love with them kind of when I was older, and when I discovered that I could cook with them. And you know, so I kind of, I think plants become really beautiful when you've discovered, you know, pieces. So yes, I'd always loved them when I was younger, played with them, had a bit of a falling out, and then rediscovered, I think I rediscovered it through another book. There was a book called Slow Gin and Beeswax, I think it was called. And it was a kind of a, like a still room style book, and talked about kind of pickled rose petals and gillyflowers and sort of Elizabethan times. So, you know, and that's where I think my journey with rose began. And then you start kind of looking around and discovering all the way that it's been used through history. You know, and it's such a beautiful thing, isn't it? I love the fact that it's so cooling. And yet at the same time in the winter, really warming and really kind of like makes you feel happy. It kind of, it just feels like in the summer, it deals with your overthought, overheat kind of moments. And yet that loss as well. And there's something about picking roses for me. When I run courses, a lot of the plants which really resonate with people are the plants which have got an emotional herbal kind of connection. So when you talk about hawthorn and rose and, you know, lemon balm and things, but especially hawthorn and rose, so that kind of being able to talk about loss and grief and that softening of being able to experience it. So many people just start talking with each other at that moment about their own losses and their own things, and it allows that to happen. And I think plants are amazing that they give you something delicious, and, you know, on one level it can be this, or on another level, it can allow you to acknowledge something really big going on. But then you can just make it about the plant. It's not about you. So it's a really lovely, it's like a kind of a good conduit, isn't it? So
that's really beautiful.
They are beautiful.
They are so beautiful. You know, I was remembering things as you were talking, Liz. So I did grow up with the name Rosalie, of course. And so
yes, I'm very jealous.
I loved roses as a kid, but then I think they got overdone because of my name. And so I got rose everything. And then somebody gave me some rose oil, but I'm sure it was like synthetic, you know, rose oil, right? I wasn't getting like hundreds of dollars of rose oil, right? It was just synthetic. And I think that turned me off of roses for a long time.
Yes, I had exactly the same as well. I can't stand that rose water kind of
And so it wasn't until later when I fell in love with wild roses and apothecary roses, you know, that are just have that more like, I don't know, that real rose scent, you know, not the synthetic, that I re-fell in love with roses again. And then of course, like you're saying, there's so many lessons with rose. There's, you know, whether it's like an energetic cooling, whether it's the lovely smell and taste, or there's that, you know, deeper dealing with loss, dealing with grief, dealing with boundaries, beauty. There's so much there. You shared a lovely recipe with us, a sweet rose dukkha. I love dukkha so much. And yeah, will you tell us about this recipe? Because this looks
When I first started kind of properly foraging, I used to work for social services. So I worked with older people who had kind of mental health problems. But the older people taught me an awful lot about kind of like plants and stuff as well. And so when I had my children, I had this really stupid idea that I thought, oh, I'll just set up like a little business that sells products at farmers markets, and I'll just go, and my daughter will be in the, you know, in her wicker basket on my back until she's like seven. Oh, not a clever idea. And so I launched a little business called Forage, and so for years have made stuff. I haven't made anything for a little while because I've been mainly writing, but at one point I sold my stuff to people like Fortnum's and stuff. And so I made products with the ingredients that grew around me, and one of them, obviously, I had roses in my garden. And so I started making things, a rose petal preserve. So actually, these recipes are in my book, because part of the reason why I put them in the book is because I don't make them so much, and I get people the whole time saying, I miss your product, I miss your rose dukkha. And so I'm like, you've got it now, you just got to buy the book and you can make your own. But yeah, so rose dukkha came about from... So although I'm really badly travelled, I feel incredibly like I travel through food and through other people's experiences of travelling. And I think that the internet has been really good for that. You know, kind of Instagram connects you with people all around the world. It's transformed wild food, hasn't it, and flavour and stuff. A lot of bad things about it, but a lot of really good in that way. And so I'd learned about things like kulfi and, you know, this lovely combination of cardamom and saffron, rose petals. And I blended them with pistachios. So I blended them with British hazelnuts, these cob nuts, which are really sweet and toasty. Mm-hmm. And the roses that I grew, that I dried. And there's something different about your own roses. If you process your, I'm sure you dry your own roses, but they're totally different to roses you buy in. They've got, roses you can buy have got like a kind of cardboardy, musty kind of smell sometimes, whereas your fresh roses dealt well are just incredible. And then if you blend those together, you end up with this little pot of kind of just the most amazing flavour that you can put onto yogurt, or you can have it in coffee, where you can, my children just used to dunk breadsticks in the rose petal syrup as their pudding into the rose dukkha. There's a load of things you could do with it. And so, and it became one of my most popular recipes and my most popular products that I sold. But its homage is kind of goes to a lot to India, but a bit of it was that the reason why I did it partly is because all of my recipes kind of resonate to a sense of place and history. And one of the reasons why I did that little blend was because not only do we have cob nuts and roses in Britain, we also have got a really, really long association with saffron. And Britain thought that, like, right from kind of like thousands of years ago, when, you know, people would sort of, the traders were sailing to the Mediterranean, they'd end up in Cornwall and started trading for tin for the, you know, Iron Age, and would bring saffron on the boats. So it was that beginning of trade. And then obviously eventually we ended up by setting up huge saffron farms in Britain. So there's places like Saffron Walden and different places which were just fields of purple saffron.
Wow.
So kind of the way that I try to kind of put recipes together, although they're simple ingredients, they often have like a bit of a story of kind of, they belong together in history and through stories. And then I think that makes food taste better.
That is also something I notice about your Buds and Blossom books is that, yeah, the history and stories that are infused in there. And it, as I was reading it, I felt like, wow, it's just the perfect amount. You know, just like I felt like it was intriguing and interesting. And it did bring the recipes to life in a way that, like, kind of showing some depth there that goes beyond just, you know, reading ingredients, yeah, and giving this kind of groundedness of it. Really well done with that.
Well, I kind of do want people to kind of have that sense of wonder that I feel very lucky that I had. And you kind of go, oh my goodness, I didn't realize they're that old. Oh my goodness, I can't believe they did that, you know? And so you start to see things in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if that's what I can do, I'm quite happy with that.
So you mentioned that, you know, if people can use their own roses, that's ideal. And that's probably one of the most common questions I get about with roses.
Yes. Is
that people say, you know, can't
they all edible?
Yeah, are they all edible? Can I use them all? And so what would be your response to that?
So my response is always yes, you know, kind of some, I don't know kind of what it's like in the States, but we had less spraying of stuff now. Obviously, I would never use a rose that you had bought from me from a florist because it could have been sprayed with huge amounts of things, but if it's been grown organically, it's different. But having your own rose, you might only have a rose that flowers once and it's not a repeat flowering. Well, you can have roses which are repeat flowering, so actually they benefit from being deadheaded. So I specifically try to have I've got a few that aren't repeat flowering, but I've got a few roses that flower through the summer. And every day that I go out and they just open, the ideal is that you pick them just before they start opening, but I want to be able to enjoy them in my garden as well. So kind of I leave them until they're kind of open in the morning, pick them in the morning before the heat of the day has taken away that plumpness of them. And I pick them. And if I'm, and we add to them, I either dry them straight away. So you pull them apart and you have to make sure that you take them. And all roses you can do this with, as long as they're not sprayed, you want to make sure they smell nice. So they will work for you in all of your kind of herbal ways if they don't smell nice. But for flavour, you want good smelling roses. And you can go, you'll notice that roses smell, in huge variations. So you'll have roses that smell like strawberries and some that smell like talcum powder and some that smell really musty and, you know, that huge variety, almost minty. And that big variety of flavour actually for me is lovely to blend them all together because you get this lovely kind of round. So I have a mixture. I've got an apothecary rose. I've got David Austin rose. Do you have David Austin? Do they sell in America?
Yes, actually.
Big.
My best friend is from Scotland. And so she clued me into David Austin and I have several David Austin roses now.
Do you have several? So many beautiful, like William Shakespeare's got this amazing flavour and it's lovely depth. So the darker the rose you get, the darker, like you make a syrup that you'll end up with. So go for roses which smell nice. There's no point in doing anything flavour-wise if the rose doesn't have any scent.
Mm-hmm.
Wild roses, dog roses have got the most beautiful scent and they just pair so beautifully with elderflower. They come out just for like a couple of weeks at the same time as elderflower.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're just, have you ever been out in the morning, really early in the morning, and it's still kind of like half four in the morning, and on a warm day when the elderflower's out and the rose is out and honeysuckle and the scent of the air, first thing when it's just full of all those essential oils, it's just beyond anything. It's amazing. No wonder we wanted to pound stuff and put it into.
No wonder.
Because the air would have smelled better for them, wouldn't it? You know, you'd have kind of been. When we were florivores, we would have probably been eating loads of roses. But yes, so any rose, as long as it's not been sprayed, is edible. Whether that means that you want to eat it or not, you want it to smell nice, then it'll taste nice. One of the things is when you're dealing with roses, if you're wanting to use them in sweet things like syrups, is at the base where the rose petal joins onto the flower head, the little kind of yellow tips have got like a bitterness to them. So when I pick my roses, if I've got like a big like David Austin style rose and you can get like a lot, I snip off the end of the rose and I would use those still. I put those into bottles of vodka and make them into little rose petal bitters for cocktails or whatever. They probably can make a tincture with them. I wonder if the medicinal property is different probably at that part. So you end up with a sweet part of the rose and you infuse those into a syrup. And people often overcook roses and floral things. So there's things to bear in mind when you're doing stuff with rose that it gives its flavour so quickly. So if you want to make a liqueur, or if you're making rose petal tinctures, whatever, it doesn't matter that you're getting the bitter and the tannins and all of that out of it. But if you're wanting to make something like a really lovely light liqueur, you literally can soak your rose petals in you know, a neutral gain alcohol for an hour in the sunlight, so probably different to how you'd make a tincture. And within that hour, all that top note, all that lovely kind of like light flavour will have gone into the alcohol. And then what we do is we kind of go, oh no, I must leave it in there for ages. And then we kind of put it in the cupboard and it comes out and they're like, tastes a bit like a cardboard with a hint of rose. And actually you've lost all of that light, love. You've made a tincture, but you've not got a, like, because, and so if you're dealing with them in alcohol, you do that. If you're wanting to make them into things like syrups, roses, don't want to be really, really cooked. So you kind of make like a sugar-based syrup. I pair my rose petals with orange and lemon juice. I kind of like the flavour that brings out from those. And then you make a kind of a really lovely, quite hot, not boiling syrup. And then you plunge with freshly picked or frozen, freshly frozen roses to open up their flavour straight into that. Stir it, cover it, leave it overnight, and then strain it. And it just becomes this beautiful pink syrup. Rose petals are pH indicators, so they make your boat, if you put it into something acidic, it'll become really, really pink. So they're really lovely. And then with drying them, if you're going to dry the rose petals, it's one of the things, I mean, and I've learned all of this the hard way, you know, from making things going wrong. So for a long time, I would be like, I can dry my whole rose petals and leave them. And of course, you've got all that moisture trapped inside that oxidizes. And so you end up with brown rose petals that taste like cardboard, that are completely pointless for food. So what you have to do is, I have a dehydrator and put a muslin cloth over them. They shrink down so much and I break them open. And so you won't, so you have like layers of them, and then you'll end up with, from a dehydrator full, you'll end up with kind of a couple of handfuls of rose petals. But they will, done properly, they'll just be amazing. And what you have to make sure is when you dry them, and I know I'm teaching Granny to suck eggs, because I mean, you probably do this you know, all the time, but when people dry them, they often make the mistake of drying them and then leaving them out, and they are so amazingly good at absorbing whatever is in the air, moisture-wise. So that's why they're so good exposed to your skin. But they'll pull in whatever moisture is in the air, so then they become all flaccid, and then they'll oxidize again. So when you dry them, make sure they're really, really crumbly and really, really dry, and you put them in an airtight container. And don't let any moisture get to them. Those COVID test things are really handy for stuff, aren't they? For stopping things from getting moisture in them. Those little sachets that become silica gels.
Right.
So they're kind of good for stopping.
I do that, like they often come in my supplements, like, you know, those kind of those sachets. And so I often put those in with the herbs. Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, and they kind of help to stop it from, because any moisture, magnolia, there's a lot of petals of flowers that do that they reabsorb. Kind of stuff, but yeah, rose petals are really big at doing that. So yeah, that's the kind of key things, is gentle heat, be really quick with how quick you know kind of if you're infusing them for a drink. And actually that drink doesn't have to be a drink, it can become a flavoring, you know. I have little bottles of things. People must think that I'm a huge drinker. I'm not really, but I'll add them to like a cream dish or whatever and use them as a flavoring extract. Yeah, and making sure that you dehydrate them really well, and then you're kind of onto a winner. Because there are so many things you can then do with them. You know, you can put them into arrabbiata sauces. You can turn the hottest tomato chilied sauce into something that makes the chilies taste just incredible, because you can deal with the heat, because the rose cools your mouth and your taste buds. So it actually was a recipe in the book for an arrabbiata. It's really simple. Just literally, it's a whole rose petal chopped up in a tomato chili sauce. With pasta, you know, it might seem a bit strange to eat pasta and rose petals, but it really, really works. You know, and then you get the benefit of, you don't necessarily taste the rose so much, but what you get is all of this amazing, all of the different layers of flavor of the chili, because you can cope with the heat. You can look really tough, you can look really hot. But that's probably why roses are in things, you know, like harissa and all of these different, you know, spice blends.
Yeah, I love the idea of, I can just see you, Liz, in your kitchen preserving roses in all these different ways. And I can tell, you know, from years of experience of like, you know, capturing that scent that's so ephemeral in a good way. And then I can just see you like, oh, I'll just try it here. I'll try it here. You know, just the experimentation of it. Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah. One of the loveliest ways I've ever eaten a rose petal was just, I've kind of always, I think they're probably just not particularly grown up from being a child. And so I used to kind of go around eating different bits in the garden. And I still do that. That's kind of how a lot of my products have come about. I used to make a honeysuckle and tarragon syrup because I had some tarragon and I had the honeysuckle, and it's like they are out together and they were amazing together. But one of the loveliest combinations is fennel with rose, fennel fronds and a rose petal. And they're lovely. Or rose petal syrup with goat's cheese on a little rose petal. And it's just like so, so delicious. Really simple. But they kind of go together because they're in season, you know, cheeses and butter, they all have their seasons, don't they? And it was just that freshness. Yeah, so it's kind of really worth people playing. Obviously, only the things they 100% know are edible. But, you know, when you've got your, when you're starting to build up what you know you can pick and know you can eat, then you start playing with your own flavours and you'll create your own, you know, you'll start creating things and food becomes playful.
I love the practicality too of trying, like how you said, like that you had honeysuckle and you had tarragon and you tried them together. Just that practicality of like, oh, I will try this, you know.
Yeah, I didn't want to look far. Doesn't always work. Sometimes.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to share about rose before we move on?
Well, I just think that for me, it, as a plant, it's obviously it's got all so many different things that kind of it's delicious. And it's, but I think going back to that, you know, saying how when I was a child, how I instinctively wanted to do stuff with it. Didn't know, I didn't kind of know you could make these things, but I just knew, but innately knew. And I think that there's something quite humbling about the fact that, you know, there's fossils which have been found of roses in America, aren't they? The earliest fossils are kind of 130 million years ago. And you can really identify this wild rose and how they captured, you know, kind of our, in humanity, you know, kind of, we literally, you know, saying we kind of walked in the wake of roses, we walked in the wake, as we evolved, as we became people, they were there, you know. And I think there's something really, really amazing about plants, how they don't just connect us to recent history, like, you know, Elizabethans, which sounds like a long time ago, but it's only a few generations, you know, lifetimes ago, really. But they connect us right back to, you know, kind of Pangaea and to kind of the world, and the world's young in that way, you know, in that kind of botanically and with people. And I just think that the more that you learn, I suppose, about the plant you've got, we have all of these. You know, we have kind of the world to thank and nature to thank for all this. But we also have humans to thank for the fact that you've got those David Austin roses and I've got them, because we are, you know, ever since we've had, well, I don't know when we really started becoming inventive. I've got a feeling we've been inventive species for a very long time. It's probably made us who we are, you know, scavenging inventive types. But an awful lot of what we've got, not just roses, but other garden plants as well. The reason why we've got them and these cultivars and these different species is because of our movement and our ingenuity and our ability to be able to make these things. And I think we're really down on humanity. You know, there's all of, you know, with nature crisis, we are doing such dreadful things to the world. And you know, it's very easy, especially for young people, I thought, for everybody to feel very concerned about the state of the world and the grief. You know, we need the rose to deal with our grief for the state of the world. And but actually, we're also amazing. And the world, I think, you know, there's not many places you can go where we have not, as mankind, humankind, womankind, that we haven't created it in a way and had an impact on it and tended it and made it. And you know, all these thousands of species, varieties of roses that you get now, a lot of that is because of us doing that. And it doesn't make us, it's not like a god complex or anything, but you know, it's about that whole, you know, we're pretty amazing. We can contribute in this amazing way, and we've kind of forgotten. So I think when you look at your roses in your garden, as beautiful, wild roses are beautiful, the uncultivated, the ones which are there, but actually the ones that we love, that, you know, girl David Austin's, and you know, and all the different ones that have been grown thousands of years by us, I think is a pretty amazing thing as well.
Yeah, it's so
I
true.
I think I waffled that about that.
Well, that's beautiful that so many different varieties and hybrids of roses do exist because humans love them so much.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk some more about buds and blossoms. And I know you have another book coming out this fall too, which kind of blows my mind. But let's talk about buds and blossoms first, since that's the one I've seen and one that I'm so excited for. So buds and blossoms, it's delicious and beautiful edible flower recipes. And I've already said some things I liked about it, like, for example, that the recipes are so beautiful. I mean, the photography on this is just incredible, but also just how simple they are, because they look doable to me, not like, oh, yeah, like, I'll never do that. But they really seem doable. And then again, like the history that goes into each herb and flower that you've chosen. But I wanted to talk about, I mean, you've chosen so many plants that I feel like there's some that are just completely unexpected for me in this, but also ones that I feel like people long to connect with. Like, for example, one of my most favorite flowers is wisteria. And wisteria is so beautiful when it comes out in the spring. It unfortunately doesn't really grow where I live, but when I've been able to spend spring in other places where they have wisteria, it's just unreal to me how just those purple drapes of, you know, these pea flowers that climb up the buildings and go over the archways and everything. So you have recipes for wisteria, rose, of course, peony was one, you know, I wouldn't really expect to see, but man, that's, I mean, another kind of, you know, looks like a rose, is not a rose, but this other one that people are so drawn to. And lilac. I mean, I feel like when lilacs are in bloom, everybody who lives in like lilac country, when they're in bloom, like wants to do, like, it's a deep yearning. You want to do something with lilacs besides just put them on the table.
And they go brown so quickly, don't they, in a bowl?
You have marigold and calendula in there. Oh, magnolia. That's another one I just feel like I love.
Yeah, and that's coming out now.
Yeah, and you're so drawn to it. And again, it's like you want to do something with that, you know, interact with it. And yeah, your magnolia recipes look absolutely just so beautiful. Gosh, there's just so many that you've, I mean, there's not that many in the plant in the book, but there's so many that like you're just so drawn to that.
Oh, thank you. I was told I had to keep it to 20. That was quite hard to keep it to 20 plants. So kind of, there were obviously ones that aren't in there that I'd have loved to have been in there, but I had to kind of choose. The majority of the plants are, I chose them because they're really easy to grow, you know, and even if you've got a kind of balcony, you can put something in a pot, you know, and there are plants which kind of we don't think of as being flowers, like figs, for example, you know, which are the flowers are hidden inside. And I love the fact that they're kind of hidden in, but yeah, kind of things that are big stalwart garden plants, but also, you know, things which hopefully make you think a little bit about food and what we regard to be food or what we regard to be, you know, medicine or whatever. One of the plants that I've got in there is water lily. That's probably the only one that is quite, you've got to have a pond to have water lily. But you don't have to have your own pond to have water lily, because actually water lily is, across the world, one of the most important food crops, especially in places where it floods. And you know, it's been eaten again for thousands of years and provides, you know, huge amounts of sustenance. And so it was a really lovely thing to be able to kind of research the book to find out where people are using stuff. So a lot of there's a lot of the book has got its influences from kind of Eurasia, because I suppose an awful lot of plants originated, you know, kind of from there, and you've got that kind of roots into kind of different kind of traditions, medicinal traditions. And one of the things I loved discovering about was a lot of the broth and the way that foods are used in China. I could have just done the whole book basically on soup, you know, Chinese medicine broths, putting things with snow pears and stuff. How I wrote it was I did a lot of research the history of it, of the plants, and then find out where they're still used or how they were used, and the kind of pairings of the flavors. So hopefully the recipes are easy, but they've also hopefully kind of connect people a little bit to the kind of history of it. So like lilac, for example, part of the olive family. And my goodness, they make olive oil taste amazing. I had some really not very good olive oil and put some dried lilacs in, and it just doesn't taste like lilac at all. It tastes like the most amazing olive oil. Wow, and
interesting.
you can stuff dodgy olives with lilac flowers. They look beautiful and they taste delicious. And you suddenly pick up that kind of flavor of things. But, and so, I've got just really simple recipes like a potato salad with lilac flowers in it. But it has to work. Flowers for me have to, if they're delicious. I suppose I've been doing stuff with edible flowers for a long time. And one of my starting points when I started kind of with forage was that pretty much everything had an edible flower in it. So my jams would always have like a flower that was, so I would make damson and honeysuckle jam. I love honeysuckle as well. And all these different, so things that came out at the same time, clover and pear and those kind of things. But for me, there was no point in putting a flower in something if it didn't taste good. And I kind of cringe sometimes when you see some recipes which partly the edible flower renaissance has gone so huge that now people are using putting stuff on which is totally toxic. You see on Instagram an awful lot, I'm sure you've seen it, beautiful cakes where they've got kind of like ranunculus stuck out of them, like don't eat that bit of cake because the sap might have got, and so I chose the plants in Buds and Blossoms because they're easy to identify. They're not all straightforward to use. Wisteria, for example, there's parts of the only part of wisteria that you can eat is the flower. Although, interestingly, some cultures do use other parts of the wisteria, and I kind of like, but that felt like that wasn't for this book. The thing was to keep it really safe. So what you do have to do when you use wisteria is if they're forming the peas because they're part of the Fabiaceae family, the pea family, they'll form these little pea pods which have got toxins in them. You have to take the peas out the flowers. But the reality is we all like the romantic notion of sitting on the step shelling beans and podding peas and that kind of thing. So you've got to just then put wisteria into that mindset and just make sure that you do that and then you're okay and you're fine. And in Turkey, I, discovered from writing it that there's a sherbet drink that's made with wisteria flowers. It's really, and it's part of traditional Turkish medicine, wisteria. And so they soak them overnight in a solution and then drain them and then make a sherbet cooling drink. And then with the wisteria flowers, which have been spent, they're then made into a jam. And
Interesting.
in China, at the same time, people will be making wisteria jam that goes into mooncakes. And so in Beijing, there's these mooncakes that you can have, which have got wisteria flower jam. And I just love how that connects, all around the world. But the thing I love most about wisteria is the lady in America who planted in Sierra Nevada, and she planted a wisteria for 8 cents, I think, on her house. And it's now, isn't it the seventh wonder of the world because she planted it and it went so mad that it swallowed her house up. And then she built another house next to it and it ate that house as well. And now it's the biggest living plant in the world. It's about an acre.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Maybe if I travel anywhere, I'll go to see with that wisteria. We should go together.
I would love
We go eating
to.
it.
There was one flower that surprised me in there because there is a lot of Eurasian influence, but then you have bee balm, which is endemic to
Yes,
America.
I love that plant. Yeah, I'm not very good at growing it. I've got to be honest with you, I'm not a very good gardener, so I do kill quite a lot of plants. But I did have that growing for a few years in my garden. Oh, it's the most beautiful flavor, isn't it?
Very fun, yes.
It's so lovely. So yeah, I it's one of my favorite plants. And actually, people grow it a lot in the UK. There's nurseries which sell just cultivars, and so there's we have the Royal Horticultural Society. They have kind of shows, and I do a lot of the demos at the different RHS shows. And there's always a nursery that has just different varieties of bee balm. And so every year I get different varieties of bee balm and proceed to kill them because I'm probably just growing them in the wrong environment. But where I teach foraging courses, I teach some of the courses I teach at a garden called Nanty Bed Gardens, which is up in the forest. It's beautiful, beautiful, one of the original permaculture gardens. And the couple that for kind of grow, they have polyculture. They didn't know that polyculture existed as a notion. They just grew in polyculture, so their vegetable garden is full of flowers, and they grow bee balm really successfully. So they grow Didymer and 50s. I can't remember the different versions, but the purple one, and they've all got such different flavors. And I love
Really do.
how they've got that there, that with the American kind of story. So yeah, they're kind of. They're put into ice cream, and because I live right next to Wales, it's like a Welsh Bala Brith, that tea flavor, the Earl Grey tea flavor. But yeah, it's a favorite plant of mine. Do you use it much in your in herbalism?
Yes, because it's kind of
Yeah.
our, we're here in North America, it's like our native oregano. So it's very, you know,
Yeah.
pungent, antimicrobial, stimulating, diaphoretic, great for sore throats, great for toothaches.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's one of those ones that when you need something hot and spicy and antimicrobial, it's a wonderful one. And yeah, so
Yeah.
fun to grow in the garden. I
Oh,
love it because the
beautiful.
hummingbirds and the moths and everybody like to
Oh,
visit it. So
yeah, we have all the wrong pollinators for that.
yeah, right, the hummingbirds, yeah.
We're not really in a hummingbird territory.
Right.
I will keep trying to grow
Yeah. Yeah, this
it.
book really, like just looking over this book, I feel like I want to go on a picnic, you know, like harvest some
Yeah.
flowers and make something beautiful and spread out a blanket. And that's just kind of
Yeah.
the feeling the book gives me is just this beauty and memorable meals. And I think there's something so special about making things with flowers because they are so ephemeral, many of them, you know, they're here today, gone tomorrow. And so it's this kind of
Yeah.
really being present in the moment with the season. Of course, you can preserve them for later, which also is very special, you know, to have rose petal syrup in January. There's something very special about that too, you
There
know.
is, but it also and it connects you to the memory, doesn't it, of when of
Right.
that memory of when you picked it and when I think there's something about it's like some you know the whole notion that fire heat chopping wood for fire heats you 3 times or whatever. I think that the gathering and growing and making and eating does it. It feeds you a number of times. It feeds your soul, doesn't it? It kind of,
Yeah,
and
oh,
then
I
when you're
love that.
eating later on, you've got that kind of yeah. And also, it connects you to that cycle of the year. You know, it's going to come again, unless you're growing bee balm like me, and it's not going to come again anymore. But
So
yeah, I think
anybody
you're.
who wants like more beauty and joy in their life, I highly recommend Buds and Blossoms because yeah,
Oh, thank
it gives
you.
so many open invitations a way to interact with these plants. And yeah, and like you said, you don't have to grow them all. Like I read that your the water lily came from the pond in your neighbors, you know. So,
Yeah.
you know, it's a fun way to build community too.
It is. It is. And you don't, and also you don't, you know, have to kind of, this doesn't, we should be eating little bits of different things the whole time. And so, you know, it might be that you have one meal, you cook that once. I'm not suggesting that you go out and kind of, because, you know, you want, partly, we want to have these beautiful gardens. I think it's really important that we feed visually ourselves as well. So I've got a little magnolia tree. I planted it when we moved here. And it was tiny, like literally like that size. And so over, and we've lived here for 18 years, and it now provides me with enough magnolias to look at and to enjoy and to allow to gather kind of a sum at the end. Because for me, you know, it's really easy when you do stuff with food to be tempted to pick it all and to go, oh, I must gather it all. I must pick all this and do that. But actually, they're there visually as well. We need to be fed and have that moment of looking out and stuff and being amongst them as they're growing as well. So, you know, you don't need much of it, you just need a little bit.
Oh my
And if
gosh,
you
that
have too much
is
of things, you get bored of it, wouldn't you? It loses its
true.
kind of its magic. So yeah,
True.
one, you know.
It just rings so true to me because I have a hard time picking the flowers from my garden. Like
Yeah.
it's a real struggle. And I keep adding like lavender, for example. I just keep adding more and more lavender plants because I'm like, when will I have enough that I'm like okay to harvest it?
Okay, to harvest it.
Yeah, but now, you know, but I like the idea of like just having enough that you can harvest a little bit to enjoy in a meal.
Yeah,
You know,
yeah.
because so many of the
Well, with
plants I
magnolia, one of the
use.
lovely things with magnolia is that when I don't know kind of whether you have kind of like hard frost, but everyone's magnolia is open, and a hard frost hits, and they just oxidize and dry and die and fall off the tree, and then don't look. Obviously, no one, everyone then hates their magnolias because they just look awful. But at that point, when the magnolias are turning brown and they're oxidizing, their flavor profile changes and you become more like a warming spice. Have you had dried magnolia before? They're so delicious. It's kind of like, well, you know, weirdly, they start to fall off the tree just as you get, you know, Easter, and in the UK, we have hot cross buns and spiced kind of baking. And that kind of, we're still in that needing to have warmth, I think, in our food. We kind of feel like we need to kind of like, just have really cooling stuff, and actually, we're still in that period, aren't we, of needing to have spice and warmth. Oh my goodness, a magnolia! If you let those petals, that they could even be, you could even gather them from the ground, or when they're just turning brown, and so they don't become this. Oh, what a shame, magnolia's gone over, and now it's become ugly. because we do that with plants, don't we? The lilac's gone ugly and brown and it's oxidized and it looks awful. And actually, we've got to let things go and let it, you know, it's kind of part of life, isn't it? But magnolia, when they turn brown, you dry them, they are so full of liquid that it takes a long time to dry. And like rose, they'll reabsorb. But when you dry them and they can oxidize, this warming spice develops. And then in Japan, people don't just use the magnolia flowers, they use the leaves as well and cook on the leaves because they're antimicrobial. So they, and they release this sort of like lemon, kind of lemongrass kind of flavor. But, you know, they've got the most amazing thing. There's magnolia fossils all around the world because they were round, flowering.
Yeah, that's the old one.
When we were a supercontinent.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I would love to hear about your second book. So you have another book coming out this fall, which is just
amazing. I do. I haven't got a copy of that yet. Yeah, so it was probably a bit of a silly idea to write two books at the same time, but I did. My kids kept, whenever I was getting stressed, they were like, yes, but you chose this, mummy. Okay. There was no sympathy. So I was really, really lucky. I feel very lucky to have been asked to do this. So my first book I wrote was a book called Forage that came out, and it was a kind of a guide in 2021, and it was a guide to wild plants and recipes and stuff. And my commission editor, my editor from Forage, both went different their own ways. And on the same day, it was a bit of a kind of a weird day, I had a phone call from both of them saying, we've got an idea for a book, two different books, Buds and Blossoms, and my other book, Wild Drinks. And would you like to write it? And I had to be, and I didn't know what to do. You know those moments where you don't really know what to do? Am I going to lose them both if I say, well, I'm working? So I just had to take a bit of a gamble and say, I've been offered to write another book today as well. And rather than turn them down, and I was like, are you happy for me to do both? And they were. And they know each other. They work for different publishers. So it's a very strange situation. So I've worked for them both before and I'm working for them both again. But actually what happened as a result is that Wild Drinks is a guide to 50, it's a very random number, 53 plants that grow again across the world and how to use them in drinks. And there's a kind of a guide to kind of how to make wild drinks and processing stuff. It's simple. It breaks things down to being really simple. So there's a bit more. It kind of leans a little bit more towards herbal from the side. So there's teas, tinctures, bitters. So it kind of where does cocktails cross over to being medicinal, to being whatever, and liqueurs, and how we actually, you know, how all of these drinks have mainly come about from wild plants, you know, and also from herbal medicine originally. So although I'm not a herbalist, I have a real interest within, you know, kind of that and how we've developed all of that. So it's a beautifully illustrated book. So it's actually illustrated by someone called Veronica, who lives in New York. She's Swedish. She's a watercolor artist. So it's been a bit of an international affair. So she's been doing the illustrations, and they're very, very beautiful. It's not an ID book. It's quite a kind of inspirational, you know, kind of, they're beautiful, beautiful illustrations, but they're not botanical illustrations, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's coming out in October, just in time to start making things like slow gin.
Well, you have been very busy, three books under your belt, and I have no doubt that these two coming out this year are going to be very successful. So yeah.
Oh, thank you. Well, if you want to talk drinks, we can talk drinks another time.
Absolutely. Well, before you go, Liz, I'd like to ask you your last question, which is, how do herbs instill hope in you?
Oh, well, I don't know whether I've already answered it. They
I
just
feel
do,
like you answered it a you know, little bit.
There's something about the fact they keep coming. And I'm not talking necessarily about kind of the hard to cultivate plants, maybe kind of the weeds, you know, these plants that we kind of don't see. That before I started foraging and gathering food, I was always really conscious and worried about how I, like, my messiness appeared. Or I would look at a verge and I'd be like, that's tatty and messy and disordered, and it didn't make me happy. It felt and I couldn't understand these wild verges. And honestly, you know, kind of, I grew up in the era of stripy lawns, you know, and everything having to be neat and manicured. I used to go along my mum and dad's garden, kind of with a knife and cut the lawn out because you just need it so, you know. And actually, there's something about the plants which it doesn't just give you hope. I think once you realize that these plants are there and they're your friends and they're knocking on our, literally knocking on our doors, aren't they? You know, the ones we try to get rid of and we spray with weed killers and try to get rid of, and they're still there. They're not giving up on us. I suppose maybe it's kind of like almost religious, isn't it? You know, kind of, they're not giving up on us. They are our synanthropic, you know, they're kind of together with man. They're kind of there. They, you know, and they're so nourishing. They're so good for us in so many ways, and they're so delicious. And they remind us of how the year cycles and how the world cycles. And they're providing us, and to know that, you know, as I said before, we're in worrying times if you don't know, well, you know, kind of that the world in the long term will be okay. But even in the short term, in our immediate future, you know, if we start looking at the plants around us that can provide us, there are sustainable ways for us to feed the world's population through the plants that grow around us, through local growing. Eating the plants you have in your garden that are beautiful, eating the weeds that grow near, you know, and yeah, I just think that it gives you hope on so many levels. I don't know what it's like to not have hope. I think that's because of the plants. I honestly do.
Yeah, well, your love of the plants just shines through so much, Liz. It's been such a pleasure to
I'm
get
very
to
good at
know
killing them as well, though, you
you.
know.
Luckily, they keep coming back for you, it
They
sounds
keep
like.
coming
Yeah.
Oh,
Well, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for making time for us, and thanks for
that's
sharing
a real
the beauty and
pleasure.
love of the plants.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it's been just so lovely to connect with you. And I think there's something so lovely, even though I never travel and I never get anywhere, to meet people across the world who share. We know each other. You know, you kind of know each other's souls, don't you, when you get plants. And I think I've met so many people over the years who you feel that shared thing with that humanity's all right. People who like plants, we're all right.
Yeah, people, absolutely. Well,
Love
thanks again, Liz.
it. Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to meet you.
Thanks for being here. Don't forget to head over to the show notes at herbswithrosaliepodcast.com to download your beautifully illustrated recipe card, and you can also get a transcript of this show. There, you'll also be able to sign up for my weekly newsletter, which is the best way to stay in touch with me. You can visit more of Liz's offerings at foragefinefoods.com. If you'd like more herbal episodes to come your way, then one of the best ways to support this podcast is by subscribing on YouTube or your favorite podcast app. I deeply believe that this world needs more herbalists and plant-centered folks, and I'm so glad that you're here as part of this herbal community. Also, a big round of thanks to the people all over the world who make this podcast happen week to week. Nicole Paul is the project manager who oversees the whole operation from guest outreach to writing show notes to actually uploading each episode and so many other things I don't even know. She really holds this whole thing together. Francesca is our fabulous video and audio editor. She not only makes listening more pleasant, she also adds beauty to the YouTube videos with plant images and video overlays. Tatiana Rusikova is the botanical illustrator who creates gorgeous plant and recipe illustrations for us. I love them. I know that you do too. Christy edits the recipe cards, and then Jenny creates them as well as the thumbnail images for YouTube. Michelle is the tech wizard behind the scenes, and Karen is our student services coordinator and customer support. For those of you who like to read along, Jennifer is who creates the transcripts each week. Xavier, my handsome French husband, is the cameraman and website IT guy. Thanks to Rising Appalachia for their beautiful song, Resilience. Find more of their music at risingappalachia.com. It takes an herbal village to make it all happen, including you. One of the best ways to retain and fully understand something you've just learned is to share it in your own words. With that in mind, I invite you to share your takeaways with me and the entire Herbs with Rosalie community. You can leave comments on my YouTube channel, on the herbswithrosaliepodcast.com show notes page, or simply hit reply to my Wednesday email. I read every comment that comes in, and I'm excited to hear your herbal thoughts on Rose. Okay, you've lasted to the very end of the show, which means you get a gold star and this herbal tidbit. Liz reminded me a lot of one of my favorite authors, Sharon Blackie, who wrote one of my absolute favorite books, This Enchanted Life. I've read that book several times and I could read it all over again, seriously. If you love strengthening your connection with the living world, then I think you'll love that book too. Liz also made me think of Mary Oliver, and it's been a while since I've shared a Mary Oliver poem in the Herbal Tidbit section, so here you are. Roses by Mary Oliver. Everyone now and again wonders about those questions that have no ready answers. First cause, God's existence, what happens when the curtain goes down and nothing stops it, not kissing, not going to the mall, not the Super Bowl. Wild roses, I said to them one morning. Do you have the answers? And if you do, would you tell me? The roses laughed softly. Forgive us, they said, but as you can see, we are just now entirely busy being roses.